Welcome to the deep dive, where we take a stack of sources, slice them open, and try to extract the crucial threads that make complex history coherent. Today, we are deep diving into Rastafarianism. And I think for most of us, Rastafari is seen as a fascinating but, well, a relatively modern phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, something born in 20th century Jamaica, defined by protest, by music, by very specific spiritual practices.
Right, very contemporary in the popular imagination.
Exactly. But the body of research we've synthesized for you today, it fundamentally challenges that timeline.
It really does.
These sources argue that Rastafarianism is not an invention, but a profound recognition, a continuation of a 4,000-year moral and historical lineage.
Yeah, that's the core idea. It's the Caribbean prophetic voice, but rooted in this ancient, ancient covenantal thought.
So our mission today is, well, it's ambitious. We need to trace that vast thread from the ancient Near East through Israel and Ethiopia, and finally into the heart of the Caribbean diaspora.
And if we do it right, we can show the incredible historical depth and coherence of the movement.
Okay, so let's start with the one word that seems to hold all of this together, covenant.
It is a massive intellectual journey, and covenant is the concept that unifies every single step. What struck me most in the sources is how they define it.
Go on.
It's not just the theological concept. It's presented as a fundamental, a human discovery, almost like a social technology that came before organized religion, born out of pure necessity.
I find that framing social technology, that's fascinating. So if it's a technology for survival, how did the sources distinguish it from something we all use constantly, like a contract?
That distinction is absolutely vital. A modern contract, you know, it governs an exchange.
Right. It's transactional.
Exactly. It's transactional. It has precise limits. And if one party fails to deliver, the agreement is usually dissolved. A covenant, on the other hand, governs identity.
Identity, how so?
It's life-binding, it's often sacred, and it's focused relentlessly on responsibility across generations.
So when you enter a covenant, you're not just making a deal, you're literally reshaping who you are, making promises to people who aren't even born yet.
That's it. You are agreeing to a moral reality that stretches time itself. And the sources explain why this happens. Covenant emerges among the vulnerable.
Where brute force isn't an option.
Precisely. Where domination is not viable. When you can't rule by might, you have to organize life around shared meaning, around memory and truth. It's the architecture of endurance.
So the story of covenant is the story of vulnerability organizing itself to survive power.
Instead of power organizing itself to dominate.
That takes us to our first segment then. This foundation, laid in the ancient Near East, long before Israel even existed as we know it.
It was a survival strategy. A promise designed to outlast simple convenience.
And the really revolutionary aspect of this, which sets it apart from all the surrounding empires, is that long horizon ethics.
Yes. A covenantal society judges its actions not by immediate profit, but by its effects on children not yet born and land not yet depleted.
It puts a moral limit on pure ambition.
Exactly. And that insight is then inherited by Israel, and the theme sharpens covenant against empire.
The sources really underscore that. Israel's whole narrative is forged in liberation. The Exodus, not in conquest. Their obligation, the law, it comes before the ownership of land.
And this anti-imperial idea is just perfectly embodied in their central symbol, the Ark of the Covenant.
We have to challenge the pop culture view of the Ark here, don't we?
We do. We have to stop seeing it as some kind of magical weapon. Mm. The sources say it was designed as a portable presence, deliberately small, hidden, and non-instrumental. You couldn't use it to build a palace or win a battle.
But how do you enforce moral limits without physical power, then?
The Ark's design enforced orientation. It wasn't about imposing power outwardly. It was about enforcing moral limits inwardly.
The fact that it was in the Holy of Holies, the most restricted innermost space, that was the lesson.
Yes, a continuous instruction. The ultimate truth can't be controlled or spectacularized.
It has to be approached with inner alignment. That idea, interiority over spectacle, is a theme that's going to come back in a powerful way with Rastafari centuries later.
Absolutely. And this internal alignment, that brings us to the prophets. They weren't royal advisors. Right. The sources called them covenant enforcers without armies. Their job was to condemn ritual that was divorced from justice, to expose a stability that was purchased at the cost of righteousness.
They spoke truth to power, which often got them persecuted. But that commitment is what preserved the people's identity, right? Through exile, through collapse.
That refusal to mistake order for righteousness. That moral clarity is the thread. It's what allowed this memory to survive.
And that prophetic function is what makes Ethiopia the essential bridge in this whole story. Moving to segment two, the sources are very clear that Ethiopia was more than just a vague, symbolic idea of Africa.
Oh, much more. It was crucial historical counter-evidence. We're talking about the ancient kingdom of Aksum, a highly developed African civilization.
And they adopted Christianity very early 4th century.
And the crucial detail is how it happened without Roman conquest, without imperial coercion.
So Ethiopian Christianity grew up outside the whole Roman Empire structure. That gives it a completely different historical meaning.
Precisely. It preserved a non-imperial perspective. The Solomonic lineage, from texts like the Kabir Nagast, is central here. The sources say we should see it not as a simple biography.
Of the Queen of Sheba and Menelik and First.
Right, but as a claim to legitimacy through fidelity to the covenant, not through conquest. It's a moral transfer of authority, not a takeover.
So authority comes from adhering to the truth, not from force of arms. And we see that logic preserved physically in the Tabot tradition.
This detail is just remarkable. Every single Ethiopian Orthodox church holds a tabot.
A sacred tablet representing the Ark.
Yes, but just like the original Ark, the tabot is never, ever displayed publicly. It is hidden, ensuring sacred authority stays decentralized and non-spectacular.
It's the ultimate resistance to co-option. If you can't parade it, you can't turn it into a political weapon. It stays an internal moral force.
And this logic, this separateness, it plays out in wider Christian history. We have to mention the Council of Chalcedon in 451 CE.
Okay, briefly.
That council basically standardized orthodoxy for the Roman Empire. But the churches that rejected it, the Oriental Orthodox, which includes the Ethiopian Church, they remain structurally outside that imperial hierarchy.
So that rejection preserved their version of Christianity as a way of life, oriented toward inner truth and justice.
While the imperial church, by merging faith with governance, introduced this distortion, this idea that the state could dictate spiritual reality.
And that is the long shadow that crosses the Atlantic.
That alignment of faith with empire is the very logic used to justify what came next.
Which brings us to segment three, rupture and reawakening in the Caribbean. The sources define slavery not just as economic exploitation, but as an anti-covenantal system. What does that mean in practice?
It means that for slavery to work, it required the complete destruction of identity and memory. It deliberately stripped people of kinship, of their spiritual orientation, their language, and, crucial to this discussion, their inner authority.
Where covenant built identity across generations, slavery just severed all those ties.
It commodified people. It replaced the life-binding obligations of community with the cold contracts of ownership enforced by violence.
And so tragically, faith itself was weaponized in this system.
Exactly. The version of Christianity that was exported often emphasized obedience and submission, but without justice. It became an instrument of discipline, not liberation.
Creating a profound spiritual wound, a forced faith that denied the basic moral reality of the people who were enslaved.
And that spiritual and historical injury, it demanded a recovery project. That project really starts to manifest with Pan-Africanism.
Marcus Garvey.
Yes. Garvey's call was for historical recovery, for self-recognition, for the restoration of that stripped inner authority.
And this is where Ethiopia becomes so vital. It wasn't some fantasy homeland.
No, it was proof. Its continuous existence, its sovereignty, its non-colonized history. It just shattered the colonial narrative that Africa had no history, no civilization.
It was the antidote to historylessness.
Mm-hmm.
So when Haile Selassie I was crowned emperor in 1930, he became much more than a distant political figure. He became a sign.
A living embodiment of dignity, of Solomonic continuity, and sovereignty without imperial ambition. For oppressed people everywhere, he was a visible moral compass.
His coronation was the activation point.
It was the moment the ancient memory, that covenantal thread preserved through Ethiopia, met the acute need of the Caribbean diaspora, and the stage was set for Rastafarianism.
Which brings us to the core argument in segment four. Rastafarianism as embodied covenant. The sources are so clear here. This is not some improvised syncretic mix.
No, it's a deep recognition of the covenantal tradition that had survived, you know, just beneath the surface of colonial Christianity and oppression.
And that recognition gives Rastafari its stunning clarity, especially in how it names the false order, Babylon. In the Rastafari context, it's not chaos. Yeah. It's not lawlessness.
It is false order. It's the systemic structure that normalizes profound inequality, that extracts life and resources, and preaches obedience while actively denying justice.
It's the perfected anti-covenant, a system that sacrifices the vulnerable for the powerful.
And Zion, then, is not just a place in Africa you go to. It's the condition of right relationship with life, with truth, with dignity, here and now.
And the beauty of Rastafari is that this clarity isn't just a theory, it's lived.
Yes. The practices are the disciplines of the covenant. Think about idol living. This is a deliberate rejection of processed, exploited food systems.
The slave diet. Sugar, salt, things for plantation efficiency.
Exactly. Idol reclaims dignity by demanding a natural, responsible relationship with the land and with your own body.
And the dreadlocks. They become an active discipline too, right?
Yeah.
A visible, non-assimilating symbol that defies colonial standards of respectability.
It defies the smooth, uniform submission demanded by the plantation hierarchy. Yes. It's a sign of sovereignty over your own body, your own consciousness.
So the whole structure, dreadlocks, the heil, the chant, it's an active process of reclaiming everything.
Reclaiming the body from plantation logic, reclaiming food from extraction, and consciousness from internalized domination. It's covenant lived from the inside out.
They're showing that truth isn't just something you declare. It's something you have to inhabit.
And that leads directly to their core, non-negotiable demand. Equal rights and justice.
It's not just a political slogan.
No. It's not something that can be deferred or negotiated away. It's a moral commitment that places Rastafari right in that long prophetic tradition, the one that refuses to compromise moral reality for a false peace.
So after tracing this 4,000-year arc from the ancient Near East to modern Jamaica, what's the core lesson here? Why does this matter for us, for the listener today?
Well, the historical synthesis is profound. Rastafarianism was marginalized. It was dismissed, not because it lacked coherence.
But because of it.
Exactly. Because it held up a mirror to post-colonial societies and exposed their unresolved contradictions. It refused the false reconciliation that demanded the victims of injustice just stop asking questions.
It rejected the idea that you have to be respectable by the oppressor's standards to demand justice.
And that historical pattern is so resonant. Covenant resists systems that preserve themselves by sacrificing people. And while those systems always call covenantal thinking impractical or archaic,
our covenantal memory always outlasts them.
It does. And I think the critical lesson for you, the listener, is about the restoration of inner authority. Rastafari insists that true dignity does not and should not depend on external approval, not from markets, not from donors, not from imported cultural models.
It depends on moral truth and self-possession. That inner alignment we saw with the Ark.
Covenant is responsibility, not nostalgia. It demands we care for the land beyond just extraction, that we create systems that don't require permanent inequality to function.
It's a moral compass for our own often exhausted systems.
And this is where it all comes together. It shows that one of the Caribbean's most profound intellectual and moral contributions is also one of the world's most ancient strategies for survival.
What an incredible deep dive. Tracing a line of moral responsibility across millennia.
The ultimate takeaway here is a lesson that history just delivers over and over again. Civilizations fail, not from a lack of technology, but when they lose their covenant with life.
When growth becomes the only goal.
And people, or the planet, become expendable.
So we'll leave you with a final thought.
Given our own very acute modern challenges, the ecological crisis, widespread moral exhaustion, how can a tradition based on resistance without hatred, faith without domination, and pride without exclusion, how can that inform our own responsibility?
Our responsibility to remember forward.
To honor the past, not just for tradition's sake, but to choose dignity and lasting justice over domination, here and now.